Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
These are the words that Moses spoke to all of Israel on the Transjordan concerning the wilderness, concerning Arabah, opposite Sea of Reeds between Paran, Tophel, and Laban, and Hazeroth, and Disav, 11 days from Horeb by way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. It was the 40th year in the 11th month, in the first of the month, when Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to everything that Jehovah had commanded him to do. Or commanded them. After he had smitten Sihon, king of the Amorite, who dwelt in Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who dwelt in Ashtaroth, in Edrei, on the other side of the Jordan, in the land of Moab. Moses began explaining this Torah, saying, Jehovah our God spoke to us in Horeb, saying, enough of your dwelling by this mountain. Turn yourselves around and journey, and come to the Amorite mountain and all its neighbors in the Arabah. On the mountain, in the lowland, on the south, on the seacoast, the land of Canaanite and the Lebanon, and to the great river, the river Euphrates. See, I have given the land before you. Come and possess the land that Jehovah swore to your forefathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them and their children after them. I said to you at that time, saying, I cannot carry you alone. Jehovah your God has multiplied you, and behold, you are today like the stars of heaven in abundance. Jehovah, the God of your forefathers, add to you 1,000 times yourselves, and bless you as he has spoken of you. How can I alone carry your contentiousness, your burdens, and your quarrels? Provide for yourselves distinguished men who are wise, understanding, and well known to your tribes, and I shall appoint them as your heads. You answered me and said, the thing that you have proposed to do is good. So I took the heads of your tribes, distinguished men who are wise and well known, and I appointed them as heads over you, leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, leaders of fifties, leaders of tens, and officers for your tribes. I instructed your judges at that time, saying, listen among your brethren and judge righteously between a man and his brother or his litigant. You shall not show favoritism in judgment. Small and great alike you shall hear. You shall not tremble before any man. The judgment is God's. Any matter that is too difficult for you, you shall bring to me and I shall hear it. I commanded you at that time all the things that you should do. We journeyed from Horeb, and we went through the entire great and awesome wilderness that you saw by way of the Amorite mountain, as Jehovah our God commanded us. We came until Kadesh Barnea. I said to you, you have come until the Amorite mountain that Jehovah our God gives us. See, Jehovah your God has placed the land before you. Go up and possess as Jehovah God your forefathers has spoken to you. Do not fear and do not lose resolve. All of you approached me and said, let us send men ahead of us. Let them spy out the land and bring word back to us, the road on which we should ascend and the cities to which we should come. The idea was good in my eyes, so I took from you 12 men, one man for each tribe. They turned and ascended the mountain and came until the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. They took in their hands from the fruit of the land and brought it down to us. They brought back word to us and said, good is the land that Jehovah our God gives us. But you did not wish to ascend, and you rebelled against the word of Jehovah your God. You slandered in your tents, saying, because Jehovah's hatred for us to take us out of the land of Egypt, to deliver us in the hand of the Amorite, to destroy us. To where shall we ascend? Our brothers have melted our hearts, saying, a people greater and taller than we, cities greater and fortified to the heavens, and even the children of giants have we seen there. I said to you, do not be broken and do not fear them. Jehovah, your God, who goes before you, he shall make war for you, like everything he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. In the wilderness you have seen that Jehovah, your God, bore you as a man carries his son on the entire way that you traveled until you arrived at this place. Yet in this matter you do not believe in Jehovah, your God. Who goes before you on the way to seek out your place for you to encamp with fire by night to show you the road that you should travel with him, but the cloud by day? Jehovah heard the sound of your words, and he was incensed, and he swore, saying, if even a man of these people, this evil generation, shall see the good land that I swore to give to your forefathers, except for Caleb, son of Jephunneh, he shall see it. To him shall I give the land of which he walked, and to his children, because he followed Jehovah wholeheartedly. With me as well, Jehovah became angry because of you, saying, you too shall not come there. Joshua, son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall come there. Strengthen him, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. As for your small children, of whom you said they will be like taken captive, and your children who do not know good from evil this day, they will come there. To them shall I give it, and they shall possess it. As for you, turn yourselves around, journey to the wilderness by way of the Sea of Reeds. Then you spoke up and said, we have sinned to Jehovah. We shall go up and do battle according to everything Jehovah our God has commanded us. Every man of you girded on his weapons of war, and you were ready to ascend the mountain. Jehovah said to me, tell them, do not ascend, do not do battle, for I am not among you, so that you will not be struck down before your enemies. So I spoke to you, but you did not listen. You rebelled against the word of Jehovah, and you were willful and climbed that mountain. The Amorite who dwelt that mountain went out against you and pursued you, as the bees would do. They struck you in Seir until Hormah. Then you retreated and wept before Jehovah. But Jehovah did not listen to your voice. He did not hearken to you. You dwelt in Kadesh for many days as you dwelt. We'll stop there for a minute. Now, that's, of course, the introduction to chapter 1 for Deuteronomy. This whole, the first like 4 or 5 chapters are basically the introduction to this book. Moses is giving this series of a long speech. It's not done in one day. People speculate how many weeks it takes him to go through this entire book as far as out of these speeches. Every day he gives some part of a speech. He cites out the 10th month or whatever it is, the day he addresses everybody. And tradition says it takes him anywhere from 3 to 5 weeks to openly give all these speeches over a series of this time for people to hear and understand. I want to remind you, he's talking to generation number 2, not generation number 1. So the first generation, with the exception of the women, most of the men, actually all the men, except the ones who are young, are all dead. There's a few exceptions. Eleazar, still alive. Phinehas, still alive. Those were around. They were around the first generation. It's possible Levites were exempt because the way that God cursed that generation, he specifically stated the men of war. The Levites don't go out to war, so they don't have that authority, that ability to fight. But then he's reciting all this stuff. Remember, it's generation number 2. They're going to have their own parent-given reasons as to why they are where they are. I mean, their parents said, well, we're here because of this reason and that reason, all these different things they were taught. Moses here is given his last opportunity to correct all that history. So this is what actually happened. For whatever you were taught, whatever excuse your parents were given or whatever, we're going to correct it and lay it all straight. This is how you ended up where you are. All right. This is how Moses is addressing this. And he's going to go through the whole process and remind them through their history, this first few chapters, of what happened and how they got where they're at. It's been 40 years of these, from children, some of them weren't even born at the time. Some of them were just young children, all growing up and having to experience this loss of their parents and their grandparents, everybody else that was around. There is indication that at least the children are aware or were aware that they deserved this. That the indication given by Zelophehad's daughters indicating they said their father died in the wilderness in his sins. So they point out it was in his sins they died in the wilderness. So his daughters recognized their father died not because of something that God did, rather because of what he did. So it's possible that there was some indication or understanding at this time, enough at least, or as well enough that people realize we got here from our own errors, not from God or not from somebody else. Point to yourself alone, all right? Just remember to understand that. And I bring that up because Moses adds and alters a lot of history in the book of Deuteronomy, the first few chapters, meaning there are events that are recorded in the book of Numbers that are not recorded the same way Moses is describing here. And the only conclusion we have is, since Moses likely is telling the truth, is that the original account is incomplete. It does not give the full details. For example, how many records do we have for the 38 years that passed? Zero. We got nothing. So was everybody just in suspended animation for 38 years? Not likely. They had to live. They had to eat. All those various things going on. So there's things are still happening. As well as there are different events that are recorded when people ask questions. For example, the man who was gathering sticks. And remember that story? And Moses has to stop. What do we do with him? And Moses says, I don't know. I have to go ask God. Go back up the mountain or go wherever the tent is. Ask God a question. What do I do with this guy? So there were events that were occurring along this time period that help reiterate and establish history and what is right and the laws that Moses were given, and people could live by them for those 38 years. Yes.
What about the first 2,000 years before Moses? There wasn't much written down about that either.
There's only so much written down. It appears by at least some account for what we have. There's information predominantly was written down from the time of Joseph onward. The reason I say this is because if you look through our Bibles, the most amount of information pops up when you reach Joseph. Lots and lots of data on Joseph. And as you, I'm sure, know a lot of your own personal parents' history because you lived with them. You knew about them. Your grandparents, a little bit less. Your great-grandparents, you might know a name if you're lucky. That's about it, right? So typically when we have go along a story and read a story, you have a mass explosion of information. We know somebody is now writing this down at that time or near that time which it's occurring. And Joseph's story, of course, as we see, is very elaborate. Lots of stories of what he did and what he was going through all of his life are very well documented. So we know Joseph probably wrote down a whole lot of data. And of course, that carried on to the generations that followed. Of course, and Moses then gathers what Joseph has with the book of Genesis, which Moses probably wrote down a lot of it, and then continues on and fills it out and finishes off Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. So a lot of information explosion at that time period. Yes, Larry. Say it again.
Probably because they were involved with Egypt during that time. Joseph on, and Egypt was very literate.
Yes, exactly. Writing things down was important. So most likely was that's where that information comes from. So the information existing dominantly shows up in Joseph. So in Moses' time, he's obviously writing a whole lot, right? He wrote Numbers, he wrote Deuteronomy, all these books he's writing and writing and writing, or somebody is. Whether he's writing or somebody's recording it, it doesn't really matter. So for whatever reason, the 38 years, Moses didn't appear to write much. I'm just speculating, my personal opinion, they're probably just living it. Meaning, here's the list of laws, God's laws, let's get used to this and actually go through the process and do it. Meanwhile, as we learn in chapter 2, which we'll read here in a minute, God was in the process of killing them off. Note, wiping out a generation in 40 years takes a lot. A lot of people have to die. There are people in their early 20s when God curses them, that you got 40 years to wait. Well, they're in their mid late 50s. How many of you are beyond your late 50s? You're still alive, aren't you? It's shocking. How'd that happen? because most people live past the late 50s. But at this time, 38 years, there isn't a single person alive. Males, at least. They're beyond about 58 or so. 57 and younger, they're all still alive. 58, they're all dead. So God's in the process of killing these people off. It's like, oh, it's such a harsh God. He killed this and that plague. Well, yeah, his goal is to kill him off in 40 years. Else, we have to wait 60 or 70 years. It would take too long. So he's in the process of wiping these people out. So as it records here, God was against us, which we'll read in chapter 2. Let's go on chapter 2. Deuteronomy chapter 2. Oh, yes, Larry, go ahead.
That caught my eye here was Moses said that this thing sounded good to him. You must have not thought too hard about that.
Yeah. Okay, so... Yeah, so we might as well talk about that now since we have the opportunity. We'll pause in Deuteronomy. So let's go back and record some information as far as what actually happened. So in this case, let's go back to the book of Numbers where that event occurred. It was, Numbers chapter, we're down somewhere here. The spies, Numbers chapter 13. So in Numbers chapter 13 and record what was going on with this whole spy event. So Numbers 13. So the record of the two are different from Deuteronomy to Numbers. Now, granted, I realize there's 38 years lapsed between these two events, but let's read a little bit as far as what the book of Numbers says occurred versus what Moses says occurs. Numbers 13 says, Jehovah spoke to Moses saying, send forth men if you please, and let them spy out the land of Canaan that I give the children of Israel. One man from his father's tribe shall you send, everyone a leader among them. Moses sent them forth to the wilderness of Paran at Jehovah's command. They were all distinguished men, head of the children of Israel, were they? I'm going to skip all their names. No offense, but go past that. Jump down to verse 17. Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, and he said to them, ascend here in the south and climb the mountain. See the land. How is it? The people that dwells in it, is it strong or weak? Is it few or numerous? And how is the land in which it dwells? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which it dwells? Are they open or are they fortified? And how is the land? Is it fertile? Is it lean? Are there trees in it or not? You shall strengthen yourselves, take the fruit of the land. The days of the season were the first ripe grapes. They spied the land of the wilderness to Zin, to the expanse approach of Hamat. They ascended the south and arrived at Hebron, where they were Anachim. Achiman, Shishai, and Talmi, the offspring of the giant. He would have been built 7 years before Zoan of Egypt. They arrived at the valley of Eshcol and cut from there the vine of one cluster of grapes before born on a double pole, and the pomegranates, the figs. They named that place the valley of Eshcol because the cluster of the children of Israel had cut from there. Stop there for a minute. So in the book of Deuteronomy, it says the people approached Moses and wanted to spy out the land. And Moses says, it's not a good idea. Let's go ahead and do that. And Book of Numbers records that God commands Moses, send forth the spies if you want to. He says, if you please, if you choose, to spy out the land. And of course, Moses gives a list of what to spy for. So a question for you, which occurred? Which is real? Which is fake? Which is true? Which is false? Well, Deuteronomy and Numbers disagree with each other. Both are true, correct. Now, what part, how did this happen? Now, I have no idea. I'll give you a really good likelihood scenario. Okay? So you have Moses. Who's leading everybody? Is it God or is it Moses? God, right? God's leading everybody. Is God going to lead them into misery and death and, you know, a hellhole? Not likely, right? When he said, I'm giving you to a land of milk and honey, right? Is that the same as a miserable place to survive? And no, not that. Those are different descriptions, right? Right, they're different. It's not a treeless, fruitless, populationless desert wasteland. He's leading them, is it? No, it's not. So what's the purpose of investigating the land? Ah, so that's the point. If you look in Deuteronomy, the way that the people were that's depicted by Moses, the way he describes it, is that they approached him because they wanted to find out, okay, what are the cities like? How should we approach it? Is the land good or not? Who are they testing then? God. They're trying to verify, is this actually true? Is God really going to lead us into this great place? So where is their doubt then? They're doubting in what is God truly leading us to. All right? So the objective, the intent when they approached Moses was, is this true? Is it true that this land is what it's supposed to be? Now Moses, having no reason to doubt, sure, we'll encourage you, we'll humor you, and let's go ahead and do this. And but just like every other time that Moses had to have, the question was brought to him, a scenario was brought to him, he always brought it to God, God, is this okay? And what God usually said, I'll rule this way, rule that way. In Numbers and Chronicles, that God said, all right, send the men out. Clearly the people approached Moses. Moses then approached God. Then God said, send them out. One man per tribe. So it appears that the sequence, though, Numbers does not record every detail, which it's not going to. In Deuteronomy, we have more information. We can now apply to Numbers and explain what actually is happening. It wasn't that God set them up necessarily to fail. They would set themselves up. And it's given to us the key. And when it says in Deuteronomy, it says God heard, so you said you slandered God. And God heard not just the words, but the sound of your words. So your intent, he heard as well. So I can say lots of words, but my inflections dictate what those words mean. So God heard not just the words, but your intent behind them. Yes, Daniel.
So maybe it was a little bit of a conception on God's part, letting him send the spies, because they've had the 38 years of dreaming and imagining what a land of milk and honey would look like.
Well, right? At this time, it was
and
2 years.
So you
years,
can imagine
right.
The stories that
you're right.
They were telling each other.
Exactly. What does that look like? What does that land? Because they came from Egypt, but they knew what that land looked like. Good or bad, you can debate that. But what are you comparing it to? Well, Egypt doesn't grow the same fruits and vegetables and whatever else that Israel grew. To different cultures, different climates. So it's going to be different than what they're accustomed to. Yes, Jeff.
That reminds me of the case of asking for a king.
Yes, and, that's a great comparison.
They were warned ahead of time, don't ask for a king.
Right.
They asked for
bad
a king.
Things, yep.
So, okay, well, this is what kind of king you're going to look for. And then gives them instructions about how to find eventually Sheol.
Right, exactly. The example given in the Torah, as far as what the type of kings, what kings are like, the multiplying horses, having lots of wives. This is not a good thing. These are bad. These are negative examples. We don't want people to be like that. And Moses warns them, which we'll get to eventually, I forgot which chapter it is, hey, kings are like this, and when you ask for one, because it's going to happen, this is how he's going to treat you. He's going to treat you miserably, but you're going to ask anyway, and then this is how he's going to live. And so if you're going to do this, expect this type of lifestyle, that he's going to live you and force you under. So this, I agree, it's like a concession. It's like, okay, if this is really what you want, go ahead and do it. I have a question for you. Did God know ahead of time they were going to have a bad report? Sure. Yes. Of course he knew. Yes, Daniel.
So this is just like us waiting for the return of the Messiah. We're in that 38 years wandering around.
Waiting and waiting.
Telling stories to each other about what's the kingdom going to be like when it comes.
Yep. And it won't be. And telling our children, well, I won't be around, but you will be. How many of us do that? Oh, you'll see it. Every generation is the exact same thing. Not to make light of it, but at the same time, though, every generation sees it too. Because the moment you die, your time stops. So you go from death to you're in the kingdom. Even though the it could have been 5,000 years later, you have zero knowledge of time lapse. So when you die, you meet God in your perspective. Now everybody else who survives, no, you got to wait a long time. Well, you don't know you're waiting. You have no knowledge wait ever happened. It's just from there, your mind shuts down and then it wakes up again a moment later and you're there. you're assuming you're a decent person. I'm assuming you're not an evil scum. He has their own rules. Yes, Larry, go ahead.
Well, they were always wondering where their graves were that he was leading them to. And that's where they thought they were, probably, by the time they got there.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is just like he did to Balak. He said, well, okay, go ahead and just do what I tell you to do.
Yeah, exactly. I'm giving you a leeway to go, but be aware there are rules how you're going to get there. And how.
I'm still going to get you later on for... Yep. Wanting Before to do the thing do that I didn't want you to do in the first place.
And that's what God exactly does here. You get this, these 10, or sorry, 12 spies, and you're going to receive what comes out of it. Okay, yeah, so there are explanations for differences between these events for us, what's recorded in Deuteronomy versus Numbers. That's not the only example. There's a few other examples, which we'll get to in Deuteronomy for another chapter or two, discussing also examples that Moses gives one description that differs from the actual events, and will be explained, it's pretty obvious why, but what the differences are and how he's explained them and how we are to interpret those words. They're pretty basic, it's pretty obvious, but it's still important to remember that your Bible, if we argue discrepancies and differences, there's reasons for them. They're not I'm not going to say every discrepancy or reason, but the point is the big ones, there's obvious reasons and explanations for them. Before we continue on to chapter 2, one more thing I want to rattle off to you, let's see, In verse 37, chapter 1, now Moses made an implication here that we can debate and argue what it means. In chapter 1 of Deuteronomy, verse 37, it says, this is, by the way, this is after God was angry and said, you got 38 years of wandering to wait. He says, in verse 37, it says, with me as well, Jehovah became angry because of you, saying, you too should not come there. And Joshua, son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall come and strengthen him, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. And of course, continue on for your children. So it implies that at the event, meaning Moses is implying, at the event of the spies, that was when God told Moses, you're not going in also. As if that was the cause of it. Now, we know the record indicates that it was the whole stone thing with the water and the staff and all that kind of thing that God was upset with, which happened many, many years later, almost the tail end, actually the end, of their 38 years of wandering. That's when that whole rock thing occurrence happened, as far as where it's recorded as that the events occur, or at least appears to be at that time period. So as far as what Moses is arguing, though it appears or implies Moses saying it's because of spies, it wasn't. We ask, well, why would Moses say that? It's because he tells you why. It says in verse 7, with me as well, Jehovah became angry because of you. Right. Now, in the case of, he's making a comparison. The 10 spies, you wandered because of your reaction. Me and my problems is because of you and your reactions. So he's pointing out, you are responsible for your reactions. Your reactions, your actions affect not just you, but also everybody around you. Our whole group. In this case, was affected Moses, as well as the people. Now, Moses has his responsibility. And he even pleads to God later on, saying, God, please. And God says, stop it. Knock it off. Don't ask me again. We're done with this. But we won't go into that today. That's not part of our Torah portion. But as far as this event, so Moses makes an implication that it's the same event, but it's not. It is, he's pointing out, it's the because of you statement he's referencing. He's making comparison of both the spy event and his punishment, all because of the people's reactions and how they handle themselves. That's how he's doing things. So let's move on though. Okay, that's people complain. People meaning people who are supposed to be smarter than most of us, but I question it sometimes, about Moses blessing them in verse 11, saying, hey, may you be 1,000 times greater than you are, saying, why did you limit it to just 1,000? Oh, whatever. 1,000, it's like 600 million men. That's a lot. I wouldn't be complaining. But people complain about that because they think he should have, made a bigger number. Nothing makes a difference. So, any question about chapter 1 then? Because chapter 2 has some other interesting details. By the way, I'm going through the Torah portion. My intent is to get to Hof Torah portion. That's what I want to talk about most of my time today. So I'm going to go through this. If you have any questions chapter 2, rattle them off, but I'm going to read through chapter 2 real quick and hit a few highlights of what's going on, okay? Deuteronomy chapter 2 says, "We turned and journeyed to the wilderness toward the Sea of Reeds. Your father spoke to me, and we circled Mount Seir for many days. Your father said to me, saying, 'Enough of your circling this mountain. Turn yourselves northward. You shall command the people, saying, you are passing through the boundary of your brothers, the children of Esau, who dwelt in Seir. They will fear you, but you should be very careful. You shall not provoke them, for I shall not give you of their land even the right to set a foot, or as for an inheritance, the children of Esau have I given Mount Seir. You shall purchase food from them for money, so that you may eat, and also water that you may buy from them for money that you may drink. For Jehovah your God has blessed you in your handiwork. He knew your way in this great wilderness. This 40-year period, Jehovah your God was with you. You did not lack a thing. So he passed from our brothers, which is Esau, who dwelt in Seir, from the way of the Arabah, from Eilat, from Ezon Geber, and we turned and passed the way of the Moabite desert." Stop. Yeah, that's not what happened. The record there in chapter 2, the way it's in chapter 2, is not what occurred in record in the book of Numbers. And again, we'll explain why. So in the book of Numbers, it's recorded in Numbers chapter 20. Numbers 20 records what details Moses is leaving out. And we'll explain it because it's pretty obvious once you see, like, oh, of course. But we still have to go through it anyway. So Numbers chapter 20. Let's see, jump to verse, was it 18? Okay, verse 14. Numbers 20, verse 14. This is when Moses was actually trying to talk the king of Edom, people of Edom. "Moses sent emissaries from Kadesh, the king of Edom. So said your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that's befallen us. Our forefathers descended to Egypt, and we dwelt in Egypt many years. The Egyptians did evil to us and our forefathers. We cried out to Jehovah, and he heard our voice. He sent an emissary and took us out of Egypt. Now behold, we are in Kadesh, a city at the edge of your border. Let us pass through your land. We shall not pass through field or vineyard. We shall not drink well water. On the king's road shall we travel. We shall not veer right or left until we pass through your border." Edom said to him, "You shall not pass through me, lest I come against you with the sword." Israel said to him, "We shall go up on the highway, and if we drink your water, or I or my flock, I shall pay their price. Or nothing will happen. Let me pass through on foot." He said, "You shall not pass through." Then Edom went out against him with a massive throng and a strong hand. So Edom refused to permit Israel to pass through its border, and Israel turned away from near him. Now that's the record occurs in Numbers. Now in Deuteronomy, he recorded it very differently. It says, "They pass given. So you shall pass." In verse 6, Numbers chapter 2, "You shall purchase from them money you shall eat, for the water you shall dry for them, and the money you shall drink. Jehovah God has blessed you on your handiwork. He knew the way of the great wilderness for the 40-year period. He was with you, do not lack. So, verse 8, we passed from our brothers, the children of Esau, who dwelt in Seir, and from the way of Arabah, but from Eilat and Ebon Gezer, we turned to pass away to Moabite desert." So, what's recording? What's happening? Why is it we have two discrepancies? They do have different perspectives on what's going on. So, here's the deal. It's explained later on, I think it's Deuteronomy 20 to 23, what actually happened, okay? So, in the case of Edom, they were not allowed to pass through, but they were allowed to buy food and water. How do we know that? Because God complains and says when they ask the same thing from Moab, Moab allowed them to pass through, but would not give them food and water. So the requirement was, ask for food and water, we'll buy, and pass through. Edom did not let them pass through, but gave them food and water to buy. Moab let them pass through, remember the story of Balaam, they're on the fields of Moab, let them pass through, but they couldn't have food or water. So Moab restricted the food and water, and Edom just said, you can't pass through. So both those two tribes, mind you, they are family descendants or relatives of the Israelites. They each had their own aspect in which they allowed to happen. God was more upset with Moab than he was with Edom. Edom, not letting them pass through, God curses them, says you must not be allowed to join the Israelites for three generations. Three, for Edom. But for Moab, because you did not allow them to drink food and water, you have 10 generations to wait. So which did God value more? He thought Edom giving them food and water was more valuable than Moab allowing them to pass through. It tells you what God values. What is food and water? Life. So what's more important? Life. So value the life, and that will gain you, versus value the traveling route they happen to take. So they go the long way around Edom, but not through Moab, but they had to go short way through Moab, but unfortunately, they had no food and water through Moab. Though Moab did complain, they were licking up the grass of the field. He was upset about that, the king of Moab. So God, these two cults, two groups had acted or reacted differently from each other. Both, though, had a partial acquiescence or partial agreement that they gave to the children of Israel. Yes, Rose.
You know, I'm thinking of today all the immigrants that are coming across our border, I think we're blessed because we give them food and water.
Food and water's
although
a big thing.
We don't allow them to stay in the land illegally, we ship them back out. Wow. We nonetheless fed them and watered them before we kicked them out.
That's a big deal. You give them the provisions they need. We give them medical treatment or whatever is needed. We take care of their needs. That's important. God values that. Not that he's thrilled necessarily in everything we do. Not arguing that. We have our own cultural problems. But valuing life is important to him. He measures that and counts it in your favor in that way. Yes, Anne.
Years for them.
Each generation getting 40 years? What do you mean, each generation getting 40 years?
Well, the Edomites had three generations cursed.
Correct.
And so how many years is that now?
It depends on how long you are your generation. A generation, they specifically, the way it's Deuteronomy, what chapter is that? That's Deuteronomy, I think I wrote it down somewhere around here. Deuteronomy 23, and I should read what it says regarding Moab and Edom. Deuteronomy chapter 23 records this. It is verses, the first six verses, Deuteronomy chapter 3, 1 through 6. Deuteronomy chapter 23, it says, a man shall not marry the wife of his father, he shall not uncover the robe of his father, a man with crushed testicles or severed organs should not enter the congregation of the Lord. A Mamzer shall not enter the congregation of Jehovah, even till his tenth generation shall not enter the congregation of Jehovah. An Amorite or Moabite, by the way, first of all, stop. Ammon and Moab were two sons through incest with Lot and his daughters. But that happened many generations earlier than what this is recorded. So many generations have lapsed since then. So God's not counting from Lot. He's counting at any point in time. Okay. So an Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter the congregation of Jehovah, even their tenth generation shall enter the congregation of Jehovah to eternity, because of the fact they did not greet you with bread and water on the road when you were leaving Egypt. This is verse chapter 23, verse 4 and 5 of Deuteronomy chapter 23. Deuteronomy chapter 23. Deuteronomy 23 is what is recorded, verses, the first six verses, but in chapter 4, verse 4 and verse 5, see, I was middle of verse 5, it says, with bread and water on the road, middle of verse 5, and because he hired against you Balaam, son of Beor of Bethor, Aram Nahiram, to curse you. But Jehovah your God refused to listen to Balaam, and Jehovah your God reversed the curse to a blessing for you, because Jehovah your God loved you. You should not seek their peace nor their welfare all your days forever. But, verse 8, you shall not reject an Edomite, for he is your brother. You shall not reject an Egyptian, for you are sojourning in his land. The children who are born to them in the third generation may enter the congregation of Jehovah. So God did not curse Edom, or even the Egyptians for that matter, on while they treated Israel compared to how Moab and Ammon treated Israel. I mean, think about this for a second. Slave drivers, Egyptians, slave drivers, you were better off. Why? You just said it. They gave you food and water. They let you live. But the Egyptians were awful. Yes, they were. But not as bad as what Moab and Ammon did. That was worse in God's measurement. It blows the mind. Why would God value one as a slave owner, a slave driver, to be more valuable? Now, mind you, he's referring to Egyptians. The slave people who were slaves, their long since drivers were dead. Generations are going by. Generations have passed away. New ones are rising. He's not holding the new ones the same standard he did Pharaoh, the Egyptians that he slaughtered through all the 10 plagues and such. Each generation has their own list of fresh starts, so to speak, to make your own mistakes or your own successes. That's important that God says, I don't hold the father guilty for the son's actions. I don't hold the sons guilty of the father's actions. So new generations come. You can't hold their past against them. But with the exception of Moab and Edom, or Moab and Ammon. Yes, Daniel.
So what did Yeshua do with the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman? He blessed her for giving him water.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, her kindness, because that was more valuable than anything else. And mind you, I'm not condemning Edom for their not letting to pass through either. Note, the Israelites wandered around Mount Seir for a long time. Who owned Mount Seir? That's Mount Horeb. Who owned Mount Seir? Edom. So, Edom, you're in my territory. You can't pass through, but you can hang out there. You can wander around there. I won't bother you. You can't pass through it, but you can just hang out there in my land, and I'll just leave you be. So they weren't all anti-Israel, as far as Edomites were concerned. There was some compassion on traveling and space and enough distance given to them to survive and live on their own that's partially on Edom's land and partially not. They wandered around. Edom didn't attack them while they're wandering Edom's territory. There is some compassion Edom had. But also, I'm sure Edom made some money off of them. As far as, business is business, right? You have food, you have water, I can make some money off these people too. There is probably some self-serving going on as well on Edom's territory or side. Anyhow, so God does seem to value food and water more so than certain other aspects that are recorded here. I just want to bring it out to you, because so the record that Moses differs on numbers, both for Edom and Moab, is different than what's recorded in Deuteronomy, because Moab allowed them to pass through, but didn't give them water, and Edom gave them water and food, but didn't let them pass through. So they did, both those tribes did a partial fulfillment of the agreement, but not a full one. Yes, Larry.
Well, wasn't it earlier in there, or maybe it's later, I forget which, he said, you can't have their land. It was like there was an invasion, yes, of Canaan coming in. This is something I never heard of before, but the other tribes that were related to Jacob were allowed to have land too. He gave it to them, and they had to take it away from the people that were living there, the indigenous people too, just like the Israelites,
yes,
did.
Yes.
But there's no history for that.
There is. And that's where we got, that's how we got to in Book of Numbers, which Moses reiterates this particular event here in first chapter 2 and 3 of Deuteronomy. Discusses the fact that they took out Sihon and Og, both those two kings, Sihon and Og, of the Amorites. But Sihon took his territory from Moab. So Sihon conquered a chunk of Moab and defeated a chunk in their land a few hundred years earlier. Yes. They took that spot. And then when the Israelites come in, they're not taking it from Moab, though it once was Moab's territory. They're taking it from the Amorites, who conquered part of Moab. And that's, you got Jephthah coming in and the whole history lesson he gives. Say, hey, we didn't take it from you, Moab. Ammon and Moab, between the two of them. We didn't take it from you guys. We took it from the Amorites, who took it from you. You don't have a complaint against us. You'll get it back. You go talk to the Amorites 300 years ago and ask them to give it back to you, and then it's okay, but it's a little late now. Anyway, that's the sequence of, it's not that God couldn't take the chunk of land that was once owned by Moab or Ammon, once in the past, but not now. The point is, at this point in time in history, it was no longer owned by Moab and Ammon, which is the reason, I think, why Sihon thought he'd come out against Israel. Say, hey, Moab, you didn't fight Moab. You didn't fight Edom. I'm stronger than both of those, and you want to come across my land? Uh-uh. And Sihon comes in with full force. And what happens? They're all dead. And Og, Sihon's partner or a giant, he's also Amorite, the same bloodline. He comes in and says, well, you just defeated Sihon. Well, I'm bigger than he is. I'll come and wipe you out. And what happens? They're all dead. So God was fighting with those two, but not Moab or Ammon's territory. But it explains why Sihon thought he could conquer the Israelites, because they were too chicken to fight Moab, as far as his perspective is concerned. Not because they couldn't have done it, but he didn't understand God was not allowing them to fight Moab. But that's a different story. Let's just jump to 2 again. Where was I? I'm going to jump through. So I'm going to skip part of chapter 2. I'm going to march into... This is what I want to... one of the things I want to rattle off to you. One of the main complaints the spies had when they entered the land were tall people, right? The giants, right? Now, I want to point something out to you. In chapter 2, let's read starting in verse 1 and verse 10 in particular. But as Jehovah spoke to him, he says, you shall not distress Moab, you shall not provoke war with them, for I shall not give you an inheritance from their land, for to the children of Lot I've given Ar as an inheritance. Slow down here. This is Deuteronomy chapter 2. Back to Deuteronomy chapter 2. And I'm in verse 10. Verse 10 says, the Emim dwelt there previously, a great and populous people, and tall as the giants. They too were considered Rephaim, like the giants. And the Moabites called them Emim. And in Seir, the Horites dwelt previously. The children of Esau drove them away and destroyed them from before themselves and dwelt in their place, as Israel did to the land of its inheritance, which Jehovah gave them. Now rise up, eat yourselves across that brook. So we cross that brook. What does that just tell? What does that tell you? Now the Israelites had complained these big tall giants were there. What did their cousins do with that big tall giants? They fought them in the street and destroyed them. Oh, we can do this. Were they afraid? Did they stop? The Moabites who fought said, we have big giants. Israel says, we have big giants. Moab says, bring them on. Israel says, run away. Opposite extremes for your cousins. But that doesn't stop there, because Moab wasn't the only one. Ammon does the exact same thing with their giants. So let's continue on and jump down to verse 17. Yehovah spoke to me saying, this day you shall cross the border of Moab at Ar, and you shall approach the opposite children of Ammon, which is Moab's cousin. They're brothers. They were brothers, but now they're just relatives. You shall not distress them. You shall not provoke them, for I shall not give any of the land of the children of Ammon to you as inheritance. For the children of Israel of Lot I've given as inheritance. Verse 20. It too is considered the land of the Rephaim, the giants. The Rephaim dwelt in it previously, and the Ammonites called them Zemzumim, a great and populous people and tall as giants. And Yehovah destroyed them before them, and they drove them out and dwelt there in their place. Just as it did for the children of Esau who dwelt in Seir, who destroyed the Horite before them. They drove them out and dwelt their place until this day. So Israel is too chicken 38 years ago, and they're more numerous by the time they're doing this, by the way, because Moab and Ammon already had their territory. They had fewer numbers when they did it. Israel has more numbers, more people, and they were too afraid. But Ammon, who did it years earlier, at least a couple hundred years earlier, had fewer people. Moab, a couple hundred years earlier, had fewer people, and they saw giants and said, bring them on. What tells you the character? There's a discrepancy between these two, both descendants of, not Abraham, but Abraham's family. Same descendant line, same philosophy as far as how they were raised and how to bring it on type of attitude. And what happened?
I'm thinking the other one's trusting
Maybe they did trust God more. I don't know. Clearly, God was with them. God helped the descendants of Lot say, "Hey, we're taking these on, and don't fight. Don't shy away from it." And yet they both did it. Go ahead.
Toxic masculinity.
Wait a minute. Okay. I have my personal opinion between the two groups. Moab and Ammon did not have a philosophy of slavery in their minds, of fear. They didn't have that fear of slavery stuck in their heads, while Israel still did. That is mental of they grew up as slaves, being oppressed, and that was normal and comfortable. And they saw these big things, oh, we can't do that. We'll just be subservient to these people. We'll just... That same mentality was stuck on them. I bring that up on purpose because in a Haftorah reading, that topic comes up. That concept of, well, I'm too afraid. I cannot assert myself as a group where we as a group are not strong enough. God tends to not, apparently in the book in Isaiah when it talks about this, tends to not appreciate group mentality. Group philosophy is not his great, you know, yay thing. He tends to focus more on individual strength, not group strength. Humans tend on group strength and group philosophies, group mentalities. God seems to focus more on individuals. He likes smaller numbers rather than bigger numbers. So there's in my personal opinion, I think Israel had a weakness, in that generation at least, for a slavery mentality in their life, where they were too afraid to take on difficult tasks. I'm going to skip through some of these things, because I don't want to go through all this part, through everything. Jump through in chapter 3. I might just jump. There's one verse, chapter 2, I had to go through first. I skipped it earlier. It says chapter 2, verse 14. This is an important section to remember what's going on for 38 years. The days that we traveled, this is verse 14 of chapter 2, Deuteronomy. The days we traveled from Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the Red Brook were 38 years. And until the end, the entire generation, the men of war from the midst of the camp, as Jehovah swore to them. Even the hand of Jehovah was on them to confound them from the midst of the camp until their end. So it was the men of war finished dying from the midst of the people. So for 38 years, what was God's objective? Kill the men of war. The Israelite, for 38 years, God's objective was to kill the men who were able to go to war, of Israelites. What it says here, his hand was against them. It's like, oh, that's so hard. Wait a minute. That's compassionate. That's compassionate. If you let them die naturally, what would happen? You got 70 years or 80 years to wait. He cut down the 80 years of waiting or 70 years of waiting and knocked down to only 40. Thank you, God. What would happen if he said, you're all going to die here naturally? That's a long, long time. Yeah, some of these people lived a long time. No, how old was Moses? Old man when he dies, and Aaron, and these were old. You could live a long time. Yeah, so what was God doing? I'm going to wipe them out for 40 years. I'm going to make it quick, because 40 years is fast. We think, oh, it's a long time. No. 80 years is a long time. 100 years is a long time. 40 years is not. So when God measures it out, don't think on human terms, think on his terms. He's looking at a generation to knock off. 40 days of flood. 40 days of flood. He took 40 days of flood and knocked out a whole lot of people. That's also 40. So he could do it quickly. That was very quick. That was very destructive. The 40 years of flood was very fast, but quick destructive too. Or he took 40 years. Either way, that's a shortened period of time than it would be if he let them die naturally, isn't it? A lot shorter. Well, but no buts. That's how God works. He doesn't work on our terms. He works on his terms. And I want to point this out to you because there is a red flag in this chapter that people don't like. But it's important to remember, God's doing this, and he makes the decisions, we don't. All right? In this chapter, when it discusses, the crushing or destruction of Sichon and Og, chapter 3, there's a phrase in here which people tend to not like, but I'll read it to you because it's important to discuss. Things you don't like is when you should read, because that tells you the most. It says in the tale of chapter 2 of Deuteronomy, it says, this after Sichon went out and he destroyed them all and they fought and blah, 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 he smote him. Verse 34 of chapter 2 of Deuteronomy says, we captured all the cities at that time. We destroyed every populated city with the women and small children. We did not leave a survivor. Only animals did we loot for ourselves, and the booty of the cities did we capture. From Aroer, which by the sword of Arnon the brook, the city that's by the brook until Gilead, there was no city that was too strong for us. Yehovah our God gave everything before us. Only to the land of the children of Ammon did you not draw near, over the Jabbok brook, the mountains, and blah, blah, blah. So they killed the women and the children too. Now that doesn't usually sit well with most people. Well, men fight, right? Men go to war, this army, that army, fight the war. We don't kill the children. Little babies, what they do? Why do they deserve this? They do grow up. That's the only one they did. They also did for Og. It also records the same event. They wind up wiping out the children in Og. It says, it's written here too. Region border about this is chapter 3 discusses the destruction of Og. Verse 6. And Og, the next guy who attacked them, says, we destroyed them so as we did to Sihon, king of Heshbon, destroying every populous city, the women and small children. So the Israelites are going through not just attacking the armies and taking the women and children as slaves, is what most conquering armies would do. They slaughtered all the women and children. We ask ourselves, really? Well, put this in perspective. How many women and children died with the flood? Pretty much all of them. Maybe Moses and his family. Did God kill them all?
Yes.
It's like, oh, but isn't that harsh? What did the little children do? Did they know evil, good, and bad? No. But they all killed them anyway? Yes.
There's a resurrection.
Right. Because we look at humans as, oh, but it's our life. God says, don't worry about it. You're asleep for a while. We'll take care of you later. We'll sift out the problems later. Death is a temporary thing in God's viewpoint. It's permanent in ours. We have to tell ourselves it's not, so we can get through it. The reality is, in our life and blood, it looks permanent to our perspective. In God, it's not permanent. It's a temporary state of being. You're sleeping, you'll get up later. Don't worry about it. Don't fret over it. So in this slaughtering, we think, oh, but it's so awful. And note, we're not the only ones in modern day who thought this. The Israelites thought the same thing at that time. How do we know that? Because when they had to go do the same thing to the Midianites. Remember the Midianites, they brought the Balaam in and they did all the Cosby thing and the whole sex thing with Simeon, blah, blah, blah. They went to war and they fought the men. They captured the women and children. Moses says, no.
Oh, yeah.
Well, why? Because they didn't feel comfortable killing women and children.
Right.
It didn't sit well with the men either. It's like, but these are children. And Moses said, no. You kill the children, you kill the women. Any woman, girl who's not known a man, you can keep as far as wives. But everybody else, you kill them off. Children too. Ooh. So it's not just our modern day sensibilities that affect us. No. It affected them too, because man doesn't change. We're the same then as we are now. We're probably not quite as healthy. We have our issues, but the point is, the mentality is the same. It didn't feel comfortable then. Those men didn't like the idea of doing it. And today, we don't like the idea of doing such things. But yet, we aren't God. How many firstborn babies died in Pharaoh in Egypt? A lot. But we didn't do it. God did it. Yeah. Is it gross? Is it harsh? You can argue all those things. But that's not the point. Our sensibilities aren't the measure of which God measures by. He measures his own. He says, I know what I'm doing. You don't. Just follow suit. You'll explain later. And he actually explains a little more later on in Deuteronomy as far as why you're killing off these women and children. Yes, Jeff.
Well, in a sense, it's similar to what we're talking about with whether the people wanted to go into the land. Because when you see, well, what was it that they were really asking? You know, they're asking, is God with us or not? And often a response was, is it a small thing? Da-da-da-da-da-da. Is it a small thing? Da-da-da-da-da-da.
These things that God has done.
And right. So in a similar sense, it's like, well, do you trust me? Is it a small thing for the creator of heaven and earth to take care of this? You know, that death can be reversed.
Right. And it's hard to trust that. And Abraham had to have had that trust with Isaac. With that whole about to slaughter him. How much is what I have? That'd be really hard. Really hard. What was that? He did pay attention. Abraham trusted something that was beyond what most people I've ever heard of can do. He trusted something that was beyond what I've never met somebody, unless they're not quite mentally all there, who could do what Abraham did. It's not that easy to do. It's a hard task. Now, he didn't actually have to kill him, but that's about as close as you can get. With the raised hand coming down, that's about as close you're going to get. You need to have a unique relationship with God to be able to do that. And God's explanation that he gives for the killing of the children and such is given in Deuteronomy chapter 20. It discusses, in chapter 20, it goes to verse 10. It says, when you draw near to a city to wage war against it, you shall call out for it for peace. Just as Moses did, by the way, he called peace to the both Sihon and Og. He called peace first. They said no. It should be that if it responds to you in peace and opens for you, then the entire people found within it shall be as tribute for you. They shall serve you. But if it does not make peace with you, but makes war with you, you shall besiege it. Yehovah shall deliver it into your hand, and you shall smite all its males with the blade of the sword. Only the women and the small children, the animals, and everything that will be in the city, it is all booty. You may plunder for yourselves. You shall eat booty of your enemies, which Jehovah your God gave you. So you shall do to all the cities that are very distant from you, which are not of the cities of these nations, but from the cities of these people that Jehovah your God gives you as inheritance, you shall not allow any person to live. Rather, you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, as Jehovah your God has commanded you, so that they will not teach you to act according to all their abominations that they performed for their gods, so that you will sin to Yehovah your God. So what's the reason for killing the women and the children? What they will teach you. Now mind you, well, how bad can it be? Wait a minute. You're talking about cultures that have human sacrifice on a regular basis. They offer their living children up as burnt living and put them on fire, let them burn, and they all pray and say, oh, we're all supposed to be happy. How evil is that? That's pretty evil. They don't even kill them ahead of time. They let them burn alive. Pretty evil, and God's saying, this cannot happen. They don't even honor their own children. They don't even respect their own children. Yeah, they shut off. So there's a mentality that we have that, but no, wait a minute. Keep in perspective the culture that's going on and what they're dealing with. It's corrupt and evil in many ways. So that's what God's destroying, and they would teach you to do the same thing. And guess what? Did they teach them to do the same thing? Yes. Did Israel actually defeat all of them and wipe them all out? No. And what happened? Israel starts offering its own children. So they should have. They may have done better off if they had successfully wiped them out. Yes, Larry.
I don't think I could handle that myself.
I would have a hard time doing it myself.
But we, you know what Solomon said, you know, there's a time for everything under the season, a season under for everything under heaven.
Yep.
And I think our Messiah, from what he taught, he's not going to ask us to do it. He's coming back. He's going to have to do it. But I don't think we're going to be involved in it. So that's what I'm praying for anyway. Yeah. I want to see you come back, but I hope you don't want me to do any of the...
The killing and the slaughtering. Exactly.
That's a whole other story. I'm not going over that today. I personally would have a hard time doing it because I'm not a violent person by nature. It would be difficult for me. But I, if God orders you to do something, what do? You do it because he says you do it. But I trust by God that even though I only see this much what's in front of me, he sees what's beyond me. And I can't see that. To trust him, but if he orders me to do something, I'm going to double check him. Are you sure? Well, he has a third time. Are you really sure? But I'll throw my fleece, so to speak. But anyway, I'm going to jump to a Haftarah reading. I have a little bit of time to run into that because I'm actually mostly out of time. But the Haftarah reading talks a little bit about some of these topics in Haftarah reading, which is in Isaiah. There are some interesting things that we discussed in Deuteronomy that were brought up, and Isaiah addressed a few of them. Not actually, to be fair, it addresses a whole bunch of them, but we're not going to read all of them today. In our Haftarah reading, there are certain things that Moses rattled off in his oration, his first introductory statement. One of them was he commanded you to have judges over thousands and hundreds and fifties and all that kind of stuff to organize you and pay attention to what's right and wrong. And the focus of those judges' job was to follow what Moses taught them. Of course, the idea was that you yourselves would then follow suit and pursue what God instructed you to do, regardless how difficult or how easy it may or may not be. In Isaiah, which is our Haftarah reading, is Isaiah chapter 1. It's a Haftarah reading today. Isaiah chapter 1. There's a few things in there that we as humans tend to jump on and focus our attention on. And it may, derail some of this today, but I'm going to do my best. Isaiah 1, I'll read as much of it as I can. There'll be certain sections. But I want to point out to you, Isaiah's comparing the people of his time to some really awful individuals of the past and what they've delved, gone down into. The whole thing, objective of Moses' oration was to encourage them not to follow in the paths of all these rotten countries and peoples that they're destroying. To not pursue them, not follow their track. Well, Isaiah points out that, well, guess what? You followed their route. So, not so good for you. Isaiah 1 says, the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Isaiah 1, verse 2 says, hear, O heavens, give ear, O earth, for Jehovah has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox is its owner, the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not consider. Alas, a sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children who are corruptors. They have forsaken Jehovah. They have provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away backwards. Why should you be stricken again? You revolt more and more. The whole head is sick. The whole heart faints. From the sole of the foot, even the head. There's no soundness in it. But wounds and bruises, putrefying sores, they have not been closed or bound up or soothed with ointment oil. Your country is desolate and your cities are burned with fire. Strangers devour your land and your presence. And it is desolate as overthrown by strangers. So the daughter of Zion is left as a booth in a vineyard, as a hut in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. Unless the Lord of hosts had left us a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been made like Gomorrah. Let's stop there for a minute. So, in the case of Isaiah, he's pointing out that you've become so corrupt and disgusting that you are being basically plundered. Just like the nations of the Amorites that they were plundering in Moses' time, you were becoming just like those who received the plunder. You were acting like them. You were living like them. And it points out in the tale at verse 9, it says, unless God left us a remnant. You see, you have a big thing. A remnant is what's left over. So when you have a nation that God will said, may you be 1,000 times greater, God made them very small. Why is that? It's simple. Can you convince one person what's right and what's wrong? Can you convince 100,000 people what's right and what's wrong? No. Which can God convince easier? One person or 100,000 people? One. One at a time. So we don't have his strength and abilities, but God does. We say, oh, well, God just fixed everybody's mind. He doesn't do that. He doesn't do a flash and we're all fixed. It doesn't work that way. He just makes angels that matter and just replaces all. He wants us to think and learn. So when he scales it down and knocks down all these people down to small numbers, his goal is he can teach. You are instructable when you are alone. When you're amongst a crowd, what happens? We follow the crowd. Well, yeah, it's a mob. Or we actually today just call it democracy. Whatever the thing. We follow the crowd. We just do what everybody else does. Your individual right and wrong, you set aside because the crowd's doing this, so I should join them. They must be overall okay. Well, no, they're not. It's almost never right. Here, verse 10. Hear a word, the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear to the law of our God, you people of Gomorrah. To what purpose the multitude of your sacrifices to me, says Jehovah? I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams, the fat of fed cattle. I don't like the blood of bulls or lambs or goats. So he's pointing out to them, you are so corrupt in what you have become that all these things you normally, that I even commanded you to offer, are worthless. Here's the old statement. Remember this. Don't forget this. I believe it's, I forgot who said it again. I've forgotten. Somebody else probably remembers. That God doesn't hear the prayers of sinners. Meaning God does not hear those who dwell and live in their sin. Not someone who's repentant. That's not a sinner. A repentant person is not a sinner. Someone who's dwelling in their sin, like, oh, wow, this is great. He's not going to hear those prayers. Remember that statement because it's mentioned not in those words, but it's explained here in Isaiah chapter 1 as well. Verse 12, when you come to appear before me, who has required this from your hand to trample my courts? Bring no more futile sacrifices, incense and abomination to me, the new moons, the Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies. I cannot endure iniquity in the sacred meeting. Your new moons, your appointed feasts, my soul hates, for they are a trouble to me. I am weary of them. When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. What's he saying? You're disgusting. You're sinful. You are dwelling and living your sins. And, as right here, I won't hear your prayers. You are dwelling in your sins. You are living in it. You're enjoying it. You're advocating it. You're explaining it to people to follow you. As a result, I won't even hear your prayers. Much less, obviously, the new moons, the holidays. Those are meaningless. If God's not even going to hear our prayers, do our Shabbats mean anything at all? No. If God won't even hear me ask or talk to him, is he even bother visiting me or observing what I'm doing on any holiday? Why bother? I'm not one of his anymore. What if he won't even hear my prayer because I'm too disgusting in my own ways? Not that I'm a failure. We all are failures, but I am disgusting. There's a difference between failing and being disgusting. Being gross like Sodom and Gomorrah. Those are differences. Failures, we all make mistakes. We all fail at times. That's the point. That's what God's complaining about that. He's discussing how gross we've become in our Sodom and Gomorrah comparison. How gross was Sodom and Gomorrah? Remember the story? Yeah, pretty awful, wasn't it? So God's comparing his people to that condition. Let's continue on. The solution is, verse 16, wash yourselves, make yourselves clean. Put away the evil of your doings before me. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Reprove the oppressor. Defend the fatherless and plead for the widow. Come on now. Let us reason. And let's explain this together. says Jehovah. Though your sins are like scarlet, they'll be as white as snow. Like red crimson, they should be as wool. If you are willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall devour them by the sword. For the mouth of Jehovah has spoken. So what is his requirement? Well, it says, wash yourself, make yourselves clean. Put away the evil ones. Do good. Seek justice. Reprove the oppressor. Defend the fatherless and plead for the widow's case. Take care of these people who need help. That is his requirement. Note, he didn't say in verse 6:17, he didn't say, bring me the sacrifice at the right time. He didn't say in verse 17, don't forget to observe me every Shabbat. He didn't say in verse 17, don't forget to come to every holy day. He didn't say in verse 17, follow all of my laws. See all that? All that stuff's missing. What did he say? Seek justice? Oh, well, then you can literally just find the Torah, the justice, and find where the laws are. Reprove the oppressor? Okay, that's a different area. Defend the fatherless and plead the widow's cause? Those are pretty basic. Remember when we started out this, we discussed Moab, and they didn't give food and water, but Edom did? And what God valued? He valued life over the pathway you took. So in the case of Isaiah, what's he valuing? Is he valuing their sacrifice, the pathway, which is the procedures? Is he valuing, saying, that, oh, great, good job for Shabbats and all the holy days?
Probably not.
Not at all. He says quite opposite. I hate them. They're disgusting because your procedure, the way you're doing all these holy days, don't matter. It doesn't matter to me. It's worthless. Because you yourself aren't doing the very basic, seeking justice. The very basic stuff. Having those people who are being oppressed and allowing them to live. This is where Moses came in and was telling, was warning these people, pay attention to where you're going. I won't be with you. Pay attention to where you're going. You're not just the route you take, but when you're there, living in the land, don't allow the land to corrupt you. Because unfortunately, they did. That's where they ended up. They destroyed the Amorite kings because the Amorite kings were awful human beings. But they then became like them. It has happened that way sometimes. But that's what he's after. And of course, his reasoning is if you are willing to do these things, it can make you clean. Make you clean again. I won't go through all of it, but Isaiah, he reiterates again as far as in verse 21. And it says, how the faithful cities become a harlot. It was full of justice. Righteousness lodged in it, but now they're murderers. Your silver has become dross, your wine mixed with water. Your princes are rebellious and the companions of thieves. Everyone loves bribes and follows after rewards. They do not defend the fatherless, nor does the cause of the widow come before them. Therefore, this is the Lord of hosts, Jehovah, mighty one of Israel. Ah, I will rid myself of my adversaries and take vengeance on my enemies. I will turn my hand against you and thoroughly purge away your dross. Take away all your alloy, and I will restore your judges as at the first and your counselors as at the beginning. Afterward, you should be called the city of righteous, a faithful city. Restore you all the way back to Moses. Let's go back to the beginning. Turn around, go back where you came from. Teshuva. Whole principle. Turn around, go back where you came from. To return all the way back to Moses. All right. Rulers of thousands, hundreds, fifties. And Moses told them, and in our Torah portion, I've given you the Torah. I've given them all instructions. Rule by these. And as Moses had told them, you do not value the rich or the poor, the mighty or the weak. You do not fear them because you're speaking on God's behalf, who is greater than all these people. Go all the way back. Let's start again. Let's try this again. With, as Isaiah points out, with just the remnant, a small number. Let's work this and try this again and go through the process. Happens on a regular basis. God's pretty good at that. So these are important lessons to learn and pay attention to. the Israelites tended to be fearful in their process of how they got where they were getting, how we got 40 years in the wilderness and such and wandering. Unlike their cousins and their relatives who were not so fearful, willing to do what was a hard task and not be afraid of it. Though they themselves were corrupt in their own right, they still were not afraid to do it. In Israel, of course, Moses is imploring them, please follow these suits, as we read in Deuteronomy 1 and 2 and part of chapter 3. Follow these that are right, and don't be afraid of the kings that are greater than you. Crush them, and don't become like them. Say that a lot, I didn't hear you.
They were part of Jacob's clans too, right?
Oh, the other tribes?
No,
Moab and Ammon would not. They would not have kept any of the holy days listed in the Torah. That is not their done so. They were the same type of peoples that the Canaanites were in many ways, and that they worshiped their own pagan gods. They had their own human sacrifice. They followed the same sequence, but God promised them, "You have a territory, and I'm not taking it away from you. Whatever, it's still yours." So even modern day today, in modern day Jordan and probably the parts of Saudi Arabia mixture in there somewhere, there's probably still Moabites and still Ammonites that are still there, still occupying it today, who have been there for umpteen bazillion generations, how long it's been. They haven't left. Now, they've been captured and taken back and forth, but they're still there as a whole. God still left it to them, in spite of what they are and how they acted and all that kind of stuff. So those things are still, God still promised it is still your territory. And no one's supposed to dispossess you as far as it's given to you. Because I say ever, that's true, because unlike Israel was told, "I'm going to spit you out." But Moab wasn't told that. Ammon wasn't told that. There's no record of God saying, "I'm going to spit you out." Moab and Ammon were supposed to be taken over. I mean, they will be consumed in God's overall kingdom, but not ejected. To be brought in. Yes.
See, that'll make it easier for God to wipe them all out when the time comes. Like, oh, you're all here, yay!
Yeah, easy go. Okay, so I wanted to. It's really important for me, at least, to understand that the Book of Deuteronomy introduces that God's trying to reiterate all. Sorry, Moses had to reiterate to everybody to remember where you're heading, where you came from, and watch the final goal. Pay attention to the final goal, to how you get there, what you're going to be doing. That's the objective. And even though it may be difficult traveling through with all the killings and the fighting and stuff, maintain the goal of where you got what you got. That's why Moses gave them so many judges to rule over them, hoping, though it didn't work, that at least if there were enough people all listening and reading the Torah as leaders, they would help guide the country. And it kind of worked a little bit, but not real long. Isaiah comes along and points out that, yeah, it failed. Sorry. The leadership became rotten. And then everybody else, of course, just followed suit. So Moses tried to implore them to follow the Torah, follow his instructions with all these judges, and it didn't work. So our responsibility now, as Isaiah points out, God scales it down to remnant. God can work with individuals really well. As any one of us can testify, God's worked with each one of us individually. He's good at that. Groups of people, we tend to ignore him. But individuals he works with. So all I can say as far as Isaiah is pointing out that, yeah, sometimes God has to put the reset button on. We're starting you from scratch, the very beginning. Let's start you over yet one more time. Any questions or comments regarding this Torah portion or the Haftorah reading? Yes.
I would venture to say, possibly, that you had just mentioned, you said, well, the leaders were corrupt and they failed, and therefore, I would agree with that, but I would go using your argument that the people were corrupt.
Oh, absolutely. Sorry, no. I should be more careful. Right. Okay. You're absolutely right. It wasn't solely the leader's responsibility to succeed. It's much like a parent tries their best to raise their child up. A child will do what they're going to do. The parent can guide as best they can. The child hopefully doesn't go into too much craziness as they become an adult. But sometimes they do anyway. So, but the child was still a slowing down process in that they're being taught. So the people themselves were just as corrupt and willing to go into that corruption as anybody else would be. So I don't mean to blame it all on the leadership. My point was the most was trying to assist in giving as many judges as possible, that if you had enough of them and not a king, enough of them that hopefully would keep the people from going down too far. Though Moses wasn't dumb. He knew what was going to happen. Any questions or comments? We'll close in prayer then. Almighty God, our great Father, thank you for Shabbat, a day of rest, our holy day of time and praise and worship, Father. We ask you to bless us. Help us to listen to your voice, to follow you as best we can, Father, in spite of our own thoughts and opinions. For you are wise. You see what we cannot see. Father, we ask you to bless us this day and bless our time with one another to share the great things you taught us and in our lives and the great things that you will still teach us. We pray you, Father, ask your blessing in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hillel.info.